You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanders,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherwin Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
David Baldacci.
Thank you for tuning into Author Stories. We have a fantastic show for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting platform. You can find links to it there at HankGarner.com. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors before we get started today. The Sam Darling series by Geraldine Dufresne begins with book one, Who Killed My Boss? And you can read all the way through book eight to get ready for the release of book nine later this year. If you like cozy mysteries, you're going to love this series. Moments after hiring Samantha Darling as a therapist, Dr. Burns is murdered. Stunned by his sudden death and desperate to keep the job she just got, Sam vows to find the killer. She has two things going for her. The first is her brother Rob is a cop, and she figures the crime-solving thing has to be genetic. The second is that Sam is a little bit psychic, so finding the culprit should be a snap for her. If only she could tell the difference between her psychic vibes and indigestion. With the help of her landlord and her dog, Sam sets out to solve the murder. Along the way, she spends time with the hot new guy in town and tries not to spend time with the old high school boyfriend who stood her up on prom night. Using her vibes, her wit, and her charm, Sam solves the mystery, but not before going in the complete wrong direction more than once. Don't miss book one, Who Killed My Boss? And read the whole Sam Darling series. There's a link to it in the show notes. The Clockwork Detective, Constable of Aquiline, book one by R.A. McCandless. Aubrey Hartman left the Imperial battlefields with a pocket full of medals, a fearsome reputation, and a clockwork leg. The Imperium diverts her trip home to investigate the murder of a young druid in a strange town. She is ordered to not only find the killer, but prevent a full-scale war with the dreaded Fae. Meanwhile, the arrival of a sinister secret policeman threatens to dig up Aubrey's own secrets, ones that could ruin her career. It soon becomes clear that Aubrey has powerful enemies with plans to stop her before she gets started. Determined to solve the mystery, Aubrey must survive centaurs, thugs, and a monster of pure destruction. You need to check out this exciting new series from R.A. McCandless, Steampunk Meets Urban Fantasy, and The Clockwork Detective. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Buckle up, it's gonna get bloody. Get the Zombie Road box set featuring the first three books in the award-winning Zombie Road series for over 1,100 pages of action-packed, suspense-filled, post-apocalyptic fiction. Includes Convoy of Carnage, Bloodbath on the Blacktop, Rage on the Rails. If you're looking for an apocalyptic thrill ride filled with everyday people, heroes, villains, and a dog named Bob, then look no further. Full of thought-provoking ideas that cover uncharted territory in post-apocalyptic fiction, this series will keep you rooting for the good guys, despising the bad, and turning the pages until the very end. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special from Craig Allenson. A full cast performance of a thrilling new episode in the New York Times best-selling Expeditionary Force series. After the latest mission of the starship Flying Dutchman, Earth is safe, not just for a year, but for hundreds of years. The ship's weary crew wonders what they will do with their lives in the peacetime, but the enemy has other plans and there's danger on the home front. Starring Zachary Quinto, R.C. Bray, Kate Mulgrew, Robert Picardo, and everyone's favorite AI, Skippy the Magnificent, alongside a full cast. Includes plenty of pew 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 original sound composition and maybe some singing by R.C. Bray. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special by Craig Allenson. Now stay tuned for the show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have David Baldacci back on the show. This is the third time this year David's been on the show. He's got a fantastic new book. It's called One Good Deed, and this is a bit of a departure from the typical David Baldacci thriller that you might be thinking of. But David, I absolutely love the turn that you've taken in this new book. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back. I appreciate it.
David, it's been a busy year for you. And the last time we talked, we talked about the kind of the odd schedule that you have this year and with kind of more books than usual. What's going on with the publishing schedule? And, you know, the question everybody has is how does someone like David stay so prolific?
Yeah, for me, it's I love writing and I love creating stories. It's never been a job for me. I just, if I'm not doing it every day, then something is off and I'm not comfortable. So that's one thing. And, this particular book, One Good Deed, it's set in a time period that I've always found fascinating. Two of my favorite movies of all time are The Big Sleep and Chinatown, set in the 30s, 40s. And I've always wanted to write crime noir. And this book initially started out as a short story. And I was writing when I was on book tour last year for Long Road to Mercy. But it just morphed into something, different. And by the time it was, 3 or 4 months went by, I had 400 plus pages and it was a novel. And I just really immersed myself in it. It was just, the pages like flying from my fingertips.
Nice. It started as a short story. Do you write a lot of short stories? And do you ever know when you begin one what it's going to end up being?
I've written short stories in the past. In fact, before I wrote novels, I wrote short stories, and it's a great way to cut your teeth as a writer because short stories have to have all the elements of a longer form fiction. But I didn't know that it was going to be a novel because I wasn't sure that I had a story that would generate a novel length tale. But it turned out that was the case indeed. And I think it was because there was a lot more to the story in my head than I really realized. And I was writing one chapter after another, then all sorts of subplots sort of flinging through my mind and off I went. And that's why the pages started piling up. And in the end, it all came together really well. And talked about a time period I've always been fascinated by. My dad was a World War II veteran, as were nine of my uncles. And it was a time period that I learned a lot about growing up in the 60s and 70s. But it was a time of transition post-World War II. Everybody was knocked down by the war, and they picked themselves back up. And people were coming back from the war and moving, pulling up roots, going to new places, fresh start, seeking fame and fortune. And so it was a time of transition, and a lot of things were happening, both good and bad. And it was neat to sort of jump in the middle of all of that and tell the story.
It's really interesting because the world was in transition, and the world post-World War II became a very different place than pre-World War II. Before the war, we had the Great Depression. We were, horse and buggy was still a major mode of transportation, and that was evolving, of course. But then, the generation after World War II, we put a man on the moon. The world was a very different place. And like you, that transition, is fascinating when you're digging into that time period and really, taking a closer look. Were there things about that time period that surprised you, or that you found fascinating that maybe you had never discovered before?
Well, I think certainly it was an era where there was a great deal of optimism, because I think people, Americans particularly, felt good about the fact that they had helped win this world war and set things right again across the globe and defeated, this global evil. So they were feeling very optimistic about that. And then coming back here, there was a lot of opportunity because business boomed. The war is what got us out of the Depression. And the business was booming. People were flush with, optimism. They wanted to buy things. They wanted to build things. They wanted to have things. So it was a great economy going forward in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Before the oil crisis in the 70s, things were going really well for families. So it was sort of snowball running downhill. But for me, I wanted to kind of look at some of the other things that might take place. And in this book, there's obviously a mystery. There are crimes. There's lawyers and courtroom scenes. And one thing that, you know, as a former lawyer, I sort of knew this, but I think for the layperson, they might find really unusual is the fact that in the time period, you weren't entitled to a lawyer. The state didn't have to provide a lawyer to you if you couldn't afford one. And the police could question you without giving you any type of warning. And they could search your house or your car without getting a search warrant. So there weren't a whole lot of constitutional rights if you were, you know, a target in a criminal investigation or a defendant. You were really out there all by yourself, you know, one person on an island. And so even though, you know, the 40s and the 50s are seen as kind of, you know, civilized and modern day for the criminal justice system, not so much.
Well, and speaking of that, the main character in this book, Aloysius Archer, what a great character and what a great character name to begin with, is this character that's a little down on his luck and in the midst of a system that it seems like is just out to get him. There's everywhere he turns, it seems like it's inevitable that he's going to be back in the system. What were some of the things that you did to kind of prepare for writing that part of the story where it seems like the system is just geared to keep him there?
Yeah, it was interesting because I think the key thing about Archer is that he's a straight talking kind of guy, but he might be naive and be manipulated in certain circumstances. Again, he's not even 30 years old yet, and he's been, you know, fought in a war and been in prison, so it's not like he's seen a whole lot of normal life. And for me, I think you can get into a paranoid rut where you feel like everything is stacked against you. You're never going to get a fair shake. And you can go down a dark road and maybe decide, well, you know, what if they think I'm a criminal, then I'm going to be a criminal. Or you can try to rise above that and say, you know, I'm not going to go down that path, and I'm going to do whatever I can to survive and to show people that I am innocent of these things. And that's the path that Archer showed. But it's not easy to do. I mean, even as he says in the book, once you're labeled a criminal, you get a conviction, it's going to be really hard for him to get a decent job, and really hard for him to really participate in the booming economy because he's going to, you know, a felon. And people are always going to hold that against him. It's going to be a black mark against him for the rest of his life.
One thing that we see when you have booming economies and there's lots of money going around and lots of optimism, there tends to be a dark element to the economy. And when legitimate business grows, a lot of times the underworld business, you know, equally grows. And Archer finds himself mixed up with one of these characters and in this world. What happens to him?
Yeah, so when he gets to Pocket City, he, you know, he wants to go have a drink, even though he has a list from the parole, you know, Department of Prison says no alcohol, no women, no loose women. don't go down that route. So of course, the first thing he does is he goes and finds a bar, you know, and so he goes to the bar and he meets a guy there named Hank Pittleman, who's a local prominent businessman. And he has a proposition for Archer. And the proposition is, I got a debt that needs to be collected from this guy, Lucas Tuttle. It's a bunch of money. And I want you to go get the collateral, the car that he put up as collateral for the loan. I want you to go get the car. And if you do, I'll pay you $100. Archer thinks this can be, you know, kind of simple. And, but the person he's trying to collect the debt from is a man named Lucas Tuttle. And he's also a very prominent man thereabouts and a very forceful guy and cunning and crafty. And he has a daughter named Jackie Tuttle, who, ironically enough, but it's explained in the book, she is sort of Hank Pittleman's mistress. And Archer also meets her and, you know, kind of falls for her, too. She's quite the interesting character as well. So he gets caught up in this kind of the shady side of Pocket City right from the get-go and caught between these two titans of the town and sort of being ground down between them. So right from the get-go, he is, you know, fallen into this trap and he's not really sure how to get out of it.
We talked earlier this year about The Stars Below, your newest YA fantasy in the Vega Jane series, and we talked a little bit about world building and you know how fun it is to create a whole new world when you're writing fantasy. In One Good Deed, this setting can almost be like that because we are just far enough removed from this time period. That a lot of things are foreign to us, and you really do an excellent job of painting that setting and making us feel immersed there. When it comes to world building, whether it's fantasy or whether it's an historical time that we are far enough separated from that there are things that we need to notice about it. How do you go about the world building to immerse us so easily into the story?
I really think I build it from the inside out. So I look at, the first thing I look at are small, simple things, but things we do every day. So when I say build from the inside, I mean, I'll take a character, Aloysius Archer. How is he going to live day by day in 1949? And what do I need to show in that time period to make the reader believe that we're really in 1959? I've jumped into a time machine and we're back in 1949. So it came down to as simple as what sort of clothes will he be wearing, how much things cost there, where would he eat his meals, where would he stay, what kind of liquor would he be drinking, what kind of, you know, how would he get from point A to point B, and then move outward, you know, how does he, what sort of vernacular, you know, would he talk with other people, and, you know, the relationship with men and women were very different back then. It was a very misogynistic time period in the country and around the world. Women were clearly treated as second-class citizens. And then you move outward from there, and, you know, you show the town, the sort of businesses would be there, the modes of transportation, how the police would interact with people. If there's a crime, who is called in to investigate it, what sort of techniques they use, how is business conducted out there. It's not like you're going to have jet aircraft flying around all over the place, and you're going to have Amazon delivering stuff, and nobody has cell phones and internet and computers, nothing like that. So really, you start with the basic question of what does Archer do when he gets up in the morning? Where does he go? Where does he eat? How does he buy his clothes? What do things cost? And what would typically be around him in the town? You know, you're not going to have a CVS and a Walgreens, but you might have a Rexall drugstore. Okay, well then, and you're not going to have, you know, a minivan, but you're going to have an old Buick that, you know, built like a tank, and the weapons they use and the cigarettes they smoke. What was popular back then? Chesterfields and Camels and Lucky Strikes. And so it was really, you know, you build small and then you work out from there. And then once you do, and eventually you'll fill in all the edges of the painting, and then your world is complete. And that's all that you need to make sure that you can tell the story in a way that people really believe they're back in the 40s.
When you started the short story that became this book, what came first to you? Was it just an idea about this noir setting and story? Was it the character of Archer? How does that usually start for you?
Yeah, for me, it was the character of Archer, and I had in my mind that he was going to get on a bus after leaving prison, and he was going to go to this town. And once he got there, some strange things were going to happen to him. I wasn't really sure what at that point. But I know he was going to meet some people along the way that were going to change his life. And that he was going to be put into some type of new jeopardy after having left prison for a crime he didn't commit that would have run the risk of having him go right back to prison. So that was kind of the four walls of my story, you know, and then all I had to do was fill in the details throughout. So it was going to be him having to survive again and in a different climate, different circumstances, and avoiding having going back to prison again. And that was sort of the four walls of the short story, but as you can imagine, that can be the four walls of the novel as well. And as I was writing it, you know, each chapter, all of a sudden I thought about, you know, I've got, here's another subplot I can address. Oh, I can talk about this character some more. Oh, here's another backstory that I can do with this one that branches off neatly from what I just wrote about. And that's where it really morphed from the short story into the novel long format. And it just it did it naturally. You know, I really didn't have to force any of it. I think I just sat down and I sort of misjudged myself. You know, I think it was a novel all along. I just assumed it was going to be a short story. And I don't know why I made that assumption. I'm glad it turned out to be wrong.
Do you have a schedule that you kind of lay out for yourself? And, you know, I'm this part of the year, I'm going to work on a Memory Man novel. Another part of the year, I'm going to work on, you know, maybe a different series. Do you kind of have a work schedule laid out that you try to operate by? Or and if you do, do you leave room for, you know, a surprise book like this one?
You know, I do try to block out my time like that because I have a publishing schedule. If I know I'm going to come out in the spring and the fall, which I do most years, this year was just an anomaly. And I never had four books out in 1 year, and that's just, you know, strange. There's no plan about that. But I do, you know, so I know if I'm going to have a book out in the spring and the fall that I have to have blocks of time set aside to write, you know, whatever book those are going to be. And I try to be very methodical and disciplined and professional about it, because otherwise you can't hit your marks. And if you can't hit your marks, then you're going to miss a publication date, and that's not going to be good for anyone. So I've done this for so long, it's kind of instinctual in me now, you know, what I need to do in order to get to where I need to go.
When you're writing a novel, there are lots of writing teachers that will teach you story structure and, you know, at certain points of the story, there needs to be, you know, a rise or a fall in the action. There needs to be, you know, an inciting incident at this point. And not necessarily that you're thinking formulaic, but do you think about those things in the writing and, you know, looking at kind of how the story's flowing I guess what I'm asking is there a kind of a conscious or unconscious pattern to storytelling that you think about in the writing?
I think the best thing you can do is instead of thinking, oh, it's chapter 11 and nobody's died, I'm going to have somebody die, that if you build a story from the ground up, such that you have such an interesting premise that organically and naturally interesting things flow from that throughout the course of the story, that's the best way. It's almost like it's far better to let the water flow out and just go where it wants to go because it feels like it feels right, rather than trying to take a round peg and pound it into a square hole just because you feel like the pacing is lagging all of a sudden. If the pacing is lagging, the right fix is not to have somebody die or explode a bomb or something like that, but it's to go back and fundamentally fix what is wrong with the story. And it could be that you have not built a foundation such that it throws off enough interesting things happening along the way to support a feature length, a full novel length format. And it's better instead of trying to just make something happen for the sake of making something happen to go back and tweak the foundation of it to allow for those sorts of things to sort of naturally flow from the story you're trying to tell. And it could be as simple as adding an additional backstory, adding another character who might bring something fascinating to the story that wasn't there before, or adding another plot point that allows a character to have to go off and do something that and then in turn might put them in jeopardy or in peril somehow, or leads them to a vital clue or discovering something that, you know, helps to further the story along. And it's just tinkering on those edges is far better than just unilaterally saying, oh, I need something to happen, and this is what's going to happen.
Right. That's a great answer. When you have as many books as you do that have been as popular with readers as your books have been, then Hollywood is bound to come knocking, you know, at points. You've had movies made. I think you've got a television series in the works, don't you?
Yes, we do. We have the Amos Decker series. Yep.
Nice. When is that going to be available? Any idea?
Yeah, not yet. I mean, it's still in development, and I always tell them, and I don't want to hear from you until the premiere date. Because then I know it's going to happen. Otherwise, you just set yourself up for disappointment. It's a funny world out there.
Right. My family and I watched Absolute Power just a month or so ago, digging through some movies and said, oh, let's watch this. We haven't seen it in quite a while. And fantastic movie. But one thing that I noticed is there's an entire character written out of the movie that is a prominent character in the book. Which was kind of stunning to me at first, because I didn't think about it years ago when I saw it, but it was fresh on my mind. And, you know, as a writer who puts so much of himself and so much of your time and your, you know, soul and spirit into what you're writing, and then to see it interpreted by someone else. And it, like, what does that feel like to see your stories interpreted in a way that, that was not your original intention? And, you know, you may argue that that's the best thing for that format, but it's gotta be weird.
It is. It can be challenging. And if you let it upset you, you can upset it. And the reason Absolute Power was changed so dramatically is because Clint Eastwood was the director and the star, and he felt like we didn't need a young lawyer to be the hero. I'm the hero. I'm Clint Eastwood. So that was Clint's call, and, you know, I wasn't going to second guess him. I found going forward that when filmmakers come to me and they want to buy and adapt some of my stuff, and I said, well, let's have a talk, and let's talk about your vision for the story. And if I find that our visions are pretty similar and that they care about the integrity of the character and the stories that I created, and they're going to stay true to that, even if they do change it, or if they, you know, you can't take a 500-page novel and make it into a 2-hour movie. You're going to have to cut things out and blend characters. And I understand that because I've adapted some of my own work for film. So I get that. But the core integrity is important to me. And so if they agree to maintain that, then I'm okay with that. And then you just sit back and let them do what they do. They're professionals. They're artists. They're craftspeople. And at the end result is still not what you want it to be. Keep in mind, you'd still have the book on the shelf, and that'll be there forever. And people want to know what you wrote, how you wrote that story. All they have to do is read the book. And my litmus test is, and it's worked well for me over the years, and I've told other writers, and they've told me it's worked well for them, is that I never want to have so much control over a film or television project such that if it fails, they can blame me. That has worked incredibly well for me.
Yes. I know that you are, you have a great desire to give back, and that your philanthropy work is ongoing and pretty broad. Can you tell us about the Wish You Well Foundation and what the purpose of that is, and what it is that you guys are trying to do?
The Wish You Well Foundation, my wife and I founded it about 18 years ago, and it has a very simple mission statement. The mission statement is to eradicate illiteracy in the United States, and to that purpose, we fund literacy programs and initiatives across a whole swath of the country, pretty much all 50 states and counting, programs of all kinds and descriptions, big programs, small programs, medium-sized programs. And we also have another project called Feeding Body and Mind. We, about 7 years ago, Feeding America, we reached out to them. They run the nation's food banks, and people who are food challenged are often literacy challenged as well, because poverty and illiteracy go hand in hand. So we, on my book tours, we collect books, and we pay to have those books shipped to food banks around the country, and I think we just passed a 2 million book mark in the Feeding Body and Mind program. I know what books meant to me growing up, and I know what a void it would have been in my life, and maybe I would have turned out a lot differently if I hadn't had access to books as a kid. So I know that if we can fill homes up with books, it's going to be a really positive thing around the country for everybody, and that's what that program is trying to do.
Well, and it's such a distracting time that we live in. Also, you know, I've talked to authors before, and you know, the fact is that we're rarely in competition with one another. We're in competition with Facebook and YouTube and Netflix and those things. Those are the real competitors for eyes. And it's you know, you can have a population that's very in tune with stories, and yet never read a book. And, I think what you guys are doing is amazing work.
Well, thank you. And definitely it's very important work, and we're going to continue to do it.
That's great. What's coming up next, from you, David? I know that you usually have a fall thriller, out. Is there one coming this year as well?
It is. It's called A Minute to Midnight, and it's a sequel to Long Road to Mercy. So it brings back my FBI Special Agent Atlee Pine.
Nice. What are you writing on right now?
The book I'm working on now is a spring book. It's another Amos Decker. And I'm just starting that one now. I'm about, maybe about 11 or 12,000 words into it, and taking him on another adventure with his partner, Alex Jameson. And he's a cool character. I love writing him.
Nice. One question that that listeners have asked me to ask more of: what's your writing setup like? Is there any particular software that you like? Are there tools that you've discovered along the way that have become integral to your writing process?
I use Microsoft Word, and I typically write on a laptop. I still use old-fashioned notebooks. My wife just got me a bunch of. I love these big spiral notebooks that lay open flat. They have huge pages and huge margins. I'm with the band. It's a band book, notebook, sketchbooks, and from 1929 to 2011, it shows all the books that were banned during those years. And so I write out some of my outlines and character descriptions and plot points and things I want to include and some twists and turns along the way. And filling the notebook up with stuff like that, and that works well for me. I don't outline everything, but I like to put down some things here and there, directions I want to take and what I think characters are going to be like, and so that gives me some focus and a foundation to work from when I translate that to the actual manuscript. So that's always fun, and then obviously researching along the way. What I try to do with the research is pinpoint it so that I don't waste time, researching things that are never going to end up in the book. So I look at my battle plan, as I call it, and I say, look, what do I need to know in order to make this novel work in a way that's plausible? And then I sort of really fine-tune the research that I need to do. So instead of spending months and months on research on a particular book, I might spend 3 to 4 weeks on it, but I get exactly what I need. Because prior books, I do a lot of research, and it was great, and I learned a lot, but so much of it didn't end up being in the book. And, when you're on a publication schedule like I have, you really have to hit the ground running, and if you can save some time doing, certain things differently, it's always best to fine-tune. So that's one of the things that I fine-tuned.
Fantastic. David, it's a pleasure as always to talk. We're going to send everyone to go pick up One Good Deed. It's out everywhere now in hardcover, Kindle edition, and audiobook. If people are wanting to dig into your back catalog and follow along with news coming up, where can they find you online?
They can go to davidbaldacci.com, and that website is linked to all of my social media platforms, so Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and then wishyouwellfoundation.org will tell you all the things you need to know about the charitable arm.
Excellent. David, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show.
Oh, Sandra, I always enjoy it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
What in the name of Carl Sagan was he doing in the cemetery on Halloween? What was he thinking? He whirled, expecting the Headless Horseman himself to be waiting on the road ahead. Or was he lurking behind? He wanted to run, but now the bridge ahead worried him. Doesn't the horseman haunt bridges? Could he avoid crossing it somehow? It terrified him. Why? It was just a stupid bridge. The gloom beneath could have been the lair of a troll. Billy Goat's Gruff. Mama used to read that. The troll waits beneath for the fattest, sweetest goat. Jason thought he saw something on the far end of the bridge. A shape of some sort. He stepped onto the bridge and gripped the knotty railing. He felt the ground drop away beneath as he edged forward. His eyes remained on the shape. It's nothing. It's nothing. Is it nothing? No troll attacked him as he reached the other shore. The looming shape was only a stupid stairwell opposite the bridge that climbed up the hill and into the main cemetery. He turned left and ran, admitting defeat and letting the fear take him over. He ran southward down the long, dark road. His initial burst of adrenaline ran its course and he slowed, then walked again, limping a little. Headstones slipped past on the right. He still had enough light that he caught his reflection occasionally in the polished stone. He looked very young and very thin. He could feel his vulnerability as he walked along. He grew aware of his own body, the touch of his starchy dress shirt and his jacket and the soft weight of his backpack. He saw himself reflected in the headstones, just a container of warm fluids, flimsy work for a blade or a hoof or a sword. He felt shatterable and transient, and his next breath was not guaranteed, oh no. The leaves made a faint oceanic rustle all around. The insects sang their three-note songs. Jason Crane, Jason Crane, Jason Crane. Jason sang a wretched pop song as he walked, something about having no self-control and no bitches and not enough money. He sang it softly, absent-mindedly, as if reciting a psalm. He passed Reese, Finnerton, Bane, Ekdahl, Forrest, Black, Small. There. He saw the gate at the end of the road. But the gate would be locked, he remembered. He would have to climb the embankment and cross over the churchyard. He could see the spire of the church above and the weather vane spinning against the sky. He would rather climb this gate than face that churchyard, but the spikes on top made leaping the fence impossible. Okay, just be quick. Something caught his ear, a brittle, clipping sound. He scanned the crest above and saw a horse silhouetted among the graves. It looked to be tied to a branch of the locust tree. He had heard its hooves as it shifted from foot to foot. It rustled somehow. His breath caught. He forced himself to be calm and rational. Some Halloween thing, maybe, for some event? He found the stairs and ascended, sideways, ready to bolt if necessary. He watched the horse, but when he neared the top he saw the rider, standing upon the shallow depression of the horseman's grave. The figure was motionless, a dim shape that absorbed light and gave nothing back. He could make out the shape of the boots and the legs and two arms held away from the body, palms down. Just a man? But the cape of the thing was not normal. It contorted painfully, twisting in the air even though the wind wasn't blowing. It wrung itself and billowed and whipped slowly, as if the figure wore a wave torn from a black ocean. And above its shoulders, is he headless? Is he headless?